Keep a clock on this.
I hardly think Caldwell Butler needs any introduction. He is one of the most respected public figures this area has produced, and those of us who followed his career in Congress did so with great respect. Almost all of you know that he was born in Roanoke. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of Richmond and his law degree from the University of Virginia. He was a member of the Virginia House of Delegates from 1962 to 1972, and minority leader in that House from 1966 to 1972. He then served from the 92nd to the 97th Congress, representing the 6th Virginia District. His committees were the Judiciary Committee and the Committee on Government Operations. With all the distinction that these important positions have filled, there have been two more important roles that he's played, however. He's a member of the Raven Society, and he also served as a member of the Miller Center Commission on Presidential Disability and the 25th Amendment. We had hoped very much that each member of that commission might at some time visit the Miller Center and tell you a little bit about their personal views on this important question. We're delighted you're with us, Father.
Thank you. Thank you for that kind and generous introduction. It is my real pleasure to be here and see so many friends of long standing. I want to talk about the 25th Amendment and what we did on that commission, and most in the context of where we are today. I would point out that you alluded to my public career. I think that probably the most important thing I learned in my entire career was whenever you were called upon to make any remarks, to always borrow somebody's watch. Not necessarily to get out on time, because there are plenty of people to remind you that, but it's always nice to know that at least one person will be around when you conclude your remarks. two things have been in the news recently that you may or may not have noticed of significance in terms of the overall problem of the 25th Amendment and presidential succession and disability. One of them was a story about, I think the book is called Landslide or the Unmaking of the Presidency. It had an indication that Howard Baker, the chief of staff, shortly before he took that high office, was having some kind of a skull session with his staff or transition team, or however they were described at that time. Somebody raised a question about the mental capacity of the President Reagan at that moment, which you recall must have been the low point of his administration. And the suggestion was made that probably the highest priority, the first order of business, would be for the new chief of staff to pass judgment on whether the ought to be invoking the 25th Amendment at that moment. It bothers me a little bit that was considered in the first place, but the way the that went about it, you have the impression that from the news stories. Now, I refuse to buy these kiss and tell books, so I have to go with what's in the newspapers on this story. But basically, you had the impression that there was a memorandum to Howard Baker, and the next day they had lunch with the president or some kind of a indoctrination. They sat around the table and passed judgment on his capacity, like Captain Quigg maybe, or something of that nature. Here, the staff people were going to decide whether the president of the United States could keep his job. It bothers me that after all of the experience we've had with the 25th Amendment in this administration and all of the things that have been opportunities they have had to invoke it, that there's still this vague feeling about, well, how does it work and what involvement of the chief of staff is it? To me, of course, this is far afield from what the 25th Amendment was all about. And certainly the chief of staff is not the president's physician, is not the president's psychiatrist, and it's not his job to make this judgment, although he may be the catalyst at some point in it. So it refreshed interest, my interest in the 25th Amendment, and my pointing out once more that we really are, this administration, even after all these problems, they really haven't focused on it, which is too bad. And the second thing in the news, of course, is the debates of this last week between the president, vice presidential candidates. There wasn't any focus, as I caught it in the Charlotte terminal, so I didn't catch all of it, but I saw very little focus on the vice president's role in under the 25th Amendment and all of those things. But the debates itself raised serious questions about what is the job of the vice president and how he should be selected. So if I don't talk too much, maybe we can get around to talking about that. Let's set the stage first. I know you've had the benefit of a number of several people from our commission who've spoken to you, but at the risk of repeating, I will refresh you briefly as to where the 25th Amendment comes from. The significant thing, of course, is that there at least 9 or 10 times we've been without a vice president in this country, but we've never had to go beyond that opportunity, that situation, to use the succession statutes for those who would be president in the event both the vice president and the president were no longer around. But the assassination of President Kennedy focused on it, and that when it became an appropriate time in Lyndon Johnson's administration, the pressure was on and they moved quickly to pass the 25th Amendment. Of course, here again, the influence of the succession statute was such that while Lyndon Johnson was president, his successors would have been, in the event of his death, would have been the Speaker or the President Pro Tem of the Senate, two very powerful political figures in the legislative process. And it wasn't Lyndon Johnson's style under those circumstances to start passing legislation that would move them out of the loop. And so until he got to be president in his own right with his own vice president in 1964, there wasn't any movement. But then the movement was quick, and we got the 25th Amendment. In that background, of course, we also have to keep in mind that there's the 12th Amendment hanging around out there, which passed in the early 1800s, which in effect said that when you elect a vice president, you elect a president, or when you elect a president, you elect a vice president, and it has had the effect of, ever since then, of putting them both on the same ballot, and that to run in harness or in tandem. And that's one of the facts of life with which we have presently lived. Briefly, to set the stage, the 25th Amendment has 4 sections, the first of which is the regular succession statute, was only clarifying what, to, as everybody knows, John Tyler only succeeded to the powers of the office, but he made it perfectly clear that the office went with the powers of the office, and so he says, I'm president upon the demise of President Harrison, and that effectively made the first of succession statute clear, succession provision to the Constitution clear at that time, but we clarified it by the first section of the 25th Amendment to make it perfectly clear when one president moves on, the next guy, the vice president, is the president. Now, then we go to the second section. That's the replacement section of the 25th Amendment. That was... I've had some experience with that because while I was first in my first term in the Congress, I was on the Judiciary Committee. My predecessor, Dick Poff, told me to be sure and get on the Judiciary Committee. It's a nice, quiet place to observe what's going on in Congress without jeopardizing your career or not getting in any trouble. Well, of course, we had two vice presidentials and one presidential vice presidential replacements and one presidential impeachment in my first term. So I never thereafter consulted him on a single matter, although he had 20 years of experience in the Congress before me. But we did have Spiro Agnew got in a little trouble and decided he didn't need the job any longer. And so President Nixon nominated Gerald Ford to be President of the United States, as provided in the second section of the Constitution. That requires the approval of the House and the Senate. It's the only time, really, that the House gets into any kind of appointment process. Part of the approval process is of presidential appointments. So we were pretty careful about that. This was the first time we were invoking the new 25th Amendment, and we were very self-conscious about it. And we went about the process with a thoroughness that even exceeds the thoroughness that they now examine prospects for the Supreme Court. We knew everything about Gerald Ford from his earliest, even though he had been in public life for some 30 years, we knew all about his high school sweetheart and everything from there on. And we were very self-conscious about making a thorough examination. It was a presidential campaign when we got him before our committee. We asked him everything that you could possibly ask him about his views and eventually confirmed him. And I mention that because now we have a precedent as for how the process works. It can be done pretty quickly. It has to be done thoroughly. But the president the newly nominated vice president has the confidence of the country as a result of the way the process runs. And we ought to keep in mind that it's pretty easy now to replace a vice president if for one reason or another he gets out of the job. And I'll mention that more later. Of course, when Vice President Ford became President Ford, we had to go through the same process again with Nelson Rockefeller. And there again, we have went through the same process and did pretty well. Made the record clear about now how you're going to do this if it comes along, and I think precedents are pretty important in the development of the political process. I mentioned as an aside that while Richard Nixon was without a vice president following the resignation of Spiro Agnew, that we were pretty much in a position of deciding the House leadership, really, and when you get right down to it, the Democrats controlling both bodies, primarily in the House. They had to make a judgment as to whether to go forward with the impeachment proceeding. Of course, they didn't have all the evidence. They all only had suppositions. And I think that judgment was influenced a great deal by the fact that President Nixon had nominated a vice president that would have been acceptable to the country if he had declined and sat on his, which I think is a presidential option, just not to nominate a vice president. I don't think they would have proceeded with the impeachment. because the option was Carl Albert as Speaker of the House of Representatives. Carl Albert, in the first place, was scared to death to be President of the United States. I'm satisfied as to that. And there would never have been, and also I might answer, I don't think Richard Nixon would have handed it over to Carl Albert as in the manner in which he handed it over to Gerald Ford without a more extended fight. So the significance of the Section 2 is goes beyond the simple process of replacement. And then, of course, the third section is a voluntary voluntary temporary surrender of the functions of the office. And here again, we are the 25th Amendment is fairly clear. The problem, of course, has been identified in our lifetimes. In the case of President Eisenhower, probably more than any other, he had a number of setbacks, as you know, including operations, heart attacks, and some of the disabilities of the related conditions. But whatever his basic problem was, there was no situation in which President Eisenhower could legitimately turn over the functions of his office on a temporary basis. He made a more or less of a contract with Richard Nixon, which I think had no real meaning at all. And nobody, fortunately, had to test actions by the vice president acting for the president during periods of disability during President Eisenhower's administration. But it focused on the problem. And of course, when Lyndon Johnson came along, as I've mentioned before, following the assassination of Kennedy, and it was pretty apparent that it was a problem the country had to solve, and we did. But now we've had these two instances. I'm sure you've been over very carefully with Ken in President Reagan's administration. One of the assassination attempt, and one of the extensive surgery that he had to undergo, and extensive anesthesia. Both of those instances have focused on the third section of the 25th Amendment, and which provides basically that if the president can turn over the functions of his office to the vice president if he is confronting a period of disability, and he can do it voluntarily, and then he, upon his regaining his faculties, he simply says, I'm back, and here I am, I'm taking back my powers. It's a very simple process. We've been disappointed, as our commission pointed out, that in the first instance, an assassination, which attempt which took place within 3 months of his moving into office, we were very, our commission was disappointed to find that really the 25th Amendment didn't enter into the thinking at all as to how to deal with that particular crisis, even though the President of the United States was lucid up until the moment he went into surgery. Right, the second time that issue was confronted, when he was known that he was going to go anesthesia and surgery, he chose to write a letter which endeavored to disclaim the fact that he was using the 25th Amendment. He endeavored to disclaim that, but at the same time doing exactly what the third section of the 25th Amendment does, which was basically turn his powers over to the vice president during that brief period of disability. I enjoy telling my people that this is a classic way of how not to practice law, that my own feeling is was a one great opportunity to use the 25th Amendment in the context in which it was intended. And to have failed to do that, and to use this evasive language, was a real, real mistake, in my judgment, and I think of our commission. The reason I say that is, we live in a very complex time. The President of the United States can disappear around the world. He can go and he can go anywhere, do anything, and anything can happen to him. And to be able to constitutionally transfer the powers of office to another person without an upheaval on a temporary basis is a pretty remarkable power in the world today, and yet we have set it forth in the 25th Amendment in a way which makes it very easy to do, and to have failed to have used this bothers me, because what we really need to do is, I hate to use these words, but routine the use of this power. It just ought to be just as normal and as reflex as any other business or any other operation. If you're going to be away from the job, if you're going to be undergoing an operation, any of those things, to make it a very routine part of the presidency should have been the objective of the Reagan administration, considering his age, and it's been extremely fortunate that we haven't had to do this. But considering the position he was, to fail to make it a routine part of the presidency was something that ought to bother us all. But here again, that is, we're going to have a new president, and this new president will have the benefit of the Miller Commission study, so I'm certain that he will do just that. Our responsibility, it seems to me, is to make sure that we get through the Iron Curtain around the president-elect, make sure that he is aware of what we're talking about. Now, the voluntary part of it, the shortcoming only is that we have not yet developed, made it a part of the routine of the office. Then we come to the involuntary, the situation in which the President of the United States, for reasons of judgment of those people who are charged under the constitutional section with the responsibility of making these judgments, feel like that he is not capable of discharging his office, whether on a temporary or a permanent basis. The critical role in that, of course, is the vice president and the cabinet make this judgment in the first instance. And then, of course, if the president disagrees with it, he has his ways of challenging it. And then they get another day in court, another day or two to make their positions known. And then ultimately it can wind up before the Congress to resolve it all. But this, of course, you have to recognize, you don't become President of the United States because of your natural humility. And you don't become President of the United States walking around telling everybody I've lost my faculties. And so it's a pretty difficult position that the president finds himself in.
Involuntarily.
That's right. So it becomes involuntary. And the critical role there is the White House physician. And of course, in the first instance, it seems to me he's got to tell the president. He has got to have that degree of confidence with the president that would have an impact. But then, of course, he's got to also have that kind of a relationship with the vice president and the cabinet that makes this step, if it's necessary, makes it work. It's frightening to contemplate, but I feel like that the procedure is pretty well laid out in the Fourth Amendment, and it will work. Now let's go back for a moment and focus on the role of the vice president. The debates that we have undergone and observing in the last few days, it seems to me that we have to acknowledge that this is here in the bosom of the family, but we have to acknowledge that at some point in time, the selection process of the vice president as a running mate has broken down. In my view, I'm perfectly content with the capacity of both of these people to very Vice President of the United States. I'm perfectly content. Also, I'm perfectly comfortable with how they would serve in the office of President of the United States. I was in Washington for 10 years. And you really don't have to be that smart to be President of the United States. And you have to be lucky, and you have to have a certain amount of self-confidence. You have to be comfortable with yourself. And but the good Lord looks out for this country. And I mean, I went through the impeachment process from our Judiciary Committee, and that was the most ordinary group of men that I had you'd ever run anywhere in the Congress. And yet I felt like that the circumstances were such that each man is elevated to the situation. I think the same thing happens to the President of the United States. So what I have to say about the process is not in criticism of either one, except to say that the process has invited this selection this year has invited criticism, and so let's take a look at it. In the first place, you can't change the Constitution. It's just, the problem is not that apparent or not that acute that we could change the Constitution to alter the vice president selection process. Politically, I just don't believe that we see that. So we have to think in terms of within the framework that at present exists, what can we do? My own view is that the presidential candidates should reevaluate what they're seeking. It's getting a little bit shopworn, but it's a fact that the president, the vice president, is a heartbeat away. And what the president of the United States should be focusing on is now, today, is this person prepared to be president of the United States? And we, not the political aspects of it, not picking the candidate 2 years hence, not representing a segment, but just basically, is this man ready to be president of the United States now? We ought to be picking the vice presidential candidate for that job with that alone in mind. And we ought to be shooting at a spectrum of maybe elder statesmen, that category, as opposed to persons on their way up into the process. For example, and of course, maybe you think that Lloyd Benson moves into that category. It's my own judgment that we're not going to be able to test that theory at this moment. So he is older, and we'll let it go at that. But for example, it seems to me that George Bush would have been well advised to select Gerald Ford as an example. Here's a man with the experience who the country would be comfortable if he had to become president again. Then we ought to keep in mind that we've got Section 2 of the 25th Amendment to replace a vice president. You replace Warren Parks if you want to. If the President of the United States ought to be picking a vice president that could take over at any moment, and then with the understanding that if for any reason he wants to stand aside, that we have a very simple process to select another vice president, and that's what ought to be in the back of the mind of the President of the United States. If I've made a mistake, I can get another one. But we ought to get the best one available at the time, and that bothers me, because right now we're just simply not focusing on that aspect of it. We're focusing too much on the political aspect. And the truth of the matter is that on the vice president is a viable part of the ticket. But and the fact that Vice President is certainly a significant factor, but it's always been my observation that the only real benefit, with the possible exception of Lyndon Johnson, the only real benefit of a Vice President has been a negative factor for the other side, that very few occasions has the Vice Presidential selection been a critical to the election of the President. A poor selection has been embarrassing, and then we have in mind Ferraro more recently, and others. But there's no time for on-the-job training for your Vice President. So I'm hopeful that we will find a better way to focus on the qualifications of the Vice President, and that's where we are. I would like to see a more in-depth study of just exactly what the qualifications of the Vice President ought to be, and just exactly what he ought to be doing. I think this thing of running him around the world as the President's emissary is not really what a Vice President ought to be doing. I think the Vice President ought to be totally knowledgeable of what's going on in the White House and the administration, and not suddenly be thrust upon those responsibilities and just be ready to do them. Now, I was told this a forum and everybody would be talking, but I haven't given you an opportunity. So now, let's go back and kick around a few of the things. Tell me how comfortable you are with the ability of the President of the United States to turn over the powers of office to another. Does that bother anybody? And the second question I want to ask you is, are you comfortable with the fact that we have the power to remove a president? And can you tell me, what is the role of the chief of staff in the voluntary replacement of the president? Do you think Howard Baker had any business of sitting in judgment on the president's capacity, or where does he fit into that role generally?
My question was not on that point, but on the earlier part of your comment. It's very troublesome to me because there's a gap. That is, the president turns over voluntarily, let's say, his power, the re-triggering of the entry, his entry back into the power again, is very vague, extremely vague. I went through a surgical process comparable to President Reagan, and over the years I've had a number of partners who went through heart attacks. I know very well I would not have been competent in a matter of days or even weeks myself to make a serious judgment on an important point, and I've suffered greatly by the inadequacies in the post-heart attack period of various of my partners. Now, to thrust a basic decision on the president to take over again is wrong, it seems to me, under those circumstances. And furthermore, he may well be in no position to make a serious judgment during that period. So it seems to me we have a serious breakdown at that point.
Well, you're exactly right. And of course, we know from the press reports, not our report, that President Reagan made some judgments with reference to Iran-Contra, for example, that were probably not, made still under the influence of the post-operative problems. And so, yes, but we also know that you read that little story about how they thrust a letter at him and said, "We'll find out if he can make a judgment about signing this particular paper, then he must be all right." And he said, he got all vague and turned it this way or that way. And finally, they realized he didn't have his glasses. So after he put his glasses on him, Well, it said if he can read it, he's competent. All of our doctors have told us that, you know, as you say, that the judgment factor is effective for some little time. The only problem, there are two problems. Number one, suppose you get a president who reclaims his faculties when it's quite apparent to everybody around him that he hasn't regained his faculties. That is really vague. I mean, I think you just have to plain invoke Section 4, start all over again. The other situation is if you tell the president that you urge him to voluntarily to give up his powers, but say you don't have much control over getting them back. Of course, the reaction to that is, well, I won't. It's easy to keep it under those circumstances. So the political judgment that was made in writing the 25th Amendment, I think, is pretty sound. You've got to give him that power, and hope that he has the advisors that have the judgment to say, you know, don't rush back into this thing. And if he chooses to rush back into it, then he won't be the first president that's made a mistake. But to alter the statute and alter the Constitution to address that problem is pretty difficult. But it's there.
That's a heck of a way to run a railroad. You're going to hope that he does the right thing.
That's right. That's what we do every 4 years.
But you mentioned that it was that you wanted this second portion here to be rather routine. As we get into it, we find out some fundamental problems, and it would not be routine, just as the gentleman over there said, and just as you're talking about. What happens when the president says he is competent and wants to step back, and he is not competent? And you say, well, we hope it won't happen. Let's get into the third one, which is really vague. You say, principal officers are going to be part of the cabal with the vice president. You don't say who the principal officers are of the executive department. I don't understand why you didn't name them. Who are the principal officers? The Secretary of State or the Secretary of Education?
What are you pointing to?
I'm talking about Section 4. I'm sorry, did I say 3? Section 4 of Article 25.
He
said, whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive department, who are they? Who makes the decision that they are the principal officers? And finally, on the aspect of written declaration, this would virtually guarantee the paralysis of the federal government for 3 weeks, wouldn't it? And we worry right now about a gap of 5 minutes. And this would Congress would be called into session. You have 21 days for Congress to decide whether the vice president is correct or whether the president is correct. And nobody is president, in a sense, certainly not from public perception. What happens in those 21 days? I'm really concerned about that. This is something that ought to be repealed. Answer my question. Would not the government of the United States be paralysis?
Yeah, you've had your chance now.
But I want to nail it down as to answer the question.
Well, I have to begin by saying, you know, they wrote this thing before I got to Congress, so just so we understand.
I'll let them explain it.
But, you know, the solution to every problem is measured in terms of the alternatives. And the problem we're addressing is a disabled president. And absent this, there is no machinery for effecting removal from his office except impeachment. And that is time-consuming, very time-consuming, as you know. But let's turn. I think the majority of either the principal officers of the executive department and in order you all understand, Section 4 begins, it says that when the vice president and the majority of the principal officers of the executive departments or such other body as Congress may by law provide, when they make that judgment that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, then this that triggers this Section 4. Now, there is the such other body as Congress may by law provide. Congress has not by law provided for any other body, and we don't anticipate that they will. Now, the principal offices of the executive department is the cabinet, and the president, the cabinet, and that that is pretty a pretty well understood group of people. The executive departments are well established by the administrative provisions of the code, so there's really no serious question about who they are. That's the head of each of those departments, which are made departments under the terms of the statutes. Now, the vice president and the cabinet have to get together and make this judgment. That is a pretty big decision. The question is, they send a written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. What happens when the vice president, when the cabinet says yes and the vice president says no? It looks to me like that the vice president has got control of the process. That is, the vice president, in the first instance, has got to say, yes, I think the president can no longer discharge the duties of my office. And then a majority of the cabinet has to agree with it. That is puts the vice president in an awfully powerful position. But here again, we have to trust human nature, and I am confident, I'm comfortable with that. We don't elect vice presidents that that don't have the kind of judgment that they could make an intelligent judgment under those circumstances. Then you move, though, to the situation where the president turns around and says there's no disability exists, no inability exists, and he takes his powers back. Then you turn around, and you have 4 days to go back through it again, and then it does ultimately wind up in the Congress of the Congress of the United States, and there is a time lag there. But my own observation is, number one, Congress can move fast when they want to, and Congress can be assembled remarkably quickly if there's an intention to do so. If you don't believe that Congress can move fast, then you turn on your C-SPAN or whatever it is on Wednesday of next week, and you will see how much legislation is passed in the last 48 hours before Congress takes off for the campaign, for their recess, or for their adjournment, we hope. They can move fast, and it is all the process can be slow. As we know, for example, President Ford sent Nelson Rockefeller's name up fairly quickly for vice president, but Congress drug its heels for 120 days or so before they approved that. Congress can drag its heels, but Congress can move fast, and that's the problem you have when you elected to live in a democracy. But overall, this is a pretty quick process if we are set out to do it. It seems to me that when you get right down to it, you're not going to undertake to remove a president of the United States until there's unanimous agreement among the cabinet that the time has come. It's easy enough to cover up those problems for a limited period of time, and I suspect that's what we would have to do if we really got into that kind of crisis. and because you've got to have, you cannot have a debating society over the capability of the President of the United States. It's got to be so bad that everybody says it's time to do it. And, fortunately, we haven't been confronted with that unless it was within the Wilson administration. And of course, that problem was solved by having a strong woman at his side. And most presidents seem to be in that position as well.
Who would like to ask the next president on this?
Colwell, do you think it's practical and to have the Vice President of the United States act in a manner the same as a corporate vice president or vice chairman of the board, or in the Army as a deputy commander, that, or maybe even in his own field as the president's chief of staff?
You're asking me what I think the job of the vice president ought to be in terms of, yeah, of the administration.
Well, or
the
could it be more than just a replacement for the president? Yes.
My own view of that is that it's unfortunate that John Nance Garner, you know, says it's worth a bucket of spit or something about like that. That's what the job was worth. He was vice president for 8 years. It's unfortunate that that is people demean the office by saying that, you know, it only has a limited responsibility, just be president in case the president dies. That to me is a pretty heavy responsibility, and my own view of it is that restless vice presidents have pushed the presidents into giving them more and more responsibilities, which are more administrative or ceremonial, and that's just to me, to make him chief of staff is wrong. I just don't think that's what his job is. His job is to get ready to be president. And the way you do that is familiarize yourself with what's going on in the president's mind and what his where his policies are going and what his departments are trying to do. That's a full-time job, more than a full-time job. It's unfortunately, it's not as much in the public eye as vice presidents have become accustomed to being before they become vice president, and so they're not comfortable in it. But my own view is that we ought to get back to treating vice presidents as the next president and working on more on getting them ready for the job than these other duties. And of course, he's supposed to preside over the Senate. That to me would be really painful. Sit there and not be able to talk and listen to those guys talk on and on and on, and they are interminable. That would be the heavy part of the job. But no, my own perception of it is that the Vice President of the United States has.
Vice Presidency, do you want to raise any issues?
I just wonder if you would comment to what extent when the commission worked on the alternative procedures in case of inability or unwillingness to serve, whether it, to what extent it studied other jurisdictions where this problem exists, because it does exist in every government. I have in mind particularly the parliamentary system in England, and of course there the Prime Minister is a creature of the legislative body, but generally here in our form of government, the substitute process is geared to have the administrative end of the government fill in the successions of the short forms.
Every now and then in our discussions, we would get off on it, you know, maybe we just ought to abolish Congress or abolish and start all over again with the parliamentary system. That would only last for a minute.
Did you make any decision with respect to Congress?
We never really took a vote on it. but to be fair about this, no, I do not believe that we made any extensive research. Of course, the best the best, probably the best laboratory is the states, the 50 United States. And quite frankly, I don't remember pulling together what they do. And I don't know to this moment whether any states have picked up on the 25th Amendment and have adopted some disability provisions in their constitution. No, I think in our own modest way, we decided that we had our own system and that we had to live within it. The parliamentary system, I think, works pretty well. In many ways, but...
It's really more responsive to the public will than as ours, it seems to me.
Their ours is not supposed to be.
Well, I'll debate. I think it's fortunate. The public will, I think, cranks itself into the process so that it may very well be that we have an executive branch that's at odds with the legislative branch. But I think probably the public will is that we go to those two extremes, knowing that somewhere in between is where we're going to wind up. I think the country feels better when we've got a Democratic Congress than a Republican president than they do. Of course, well, I better not get into that. That would be cheating.
The question is obviously. Bob Beers,
Professor Beers.
Yes.
What happens, sir, when a victorious presidential candidate becomes disabled between the time of his election and his inauguration? Is there any machinery to handle that?
The determination of that is not around. We have in the 12th Amendment, and I would have to take another look at it, but basically, if the President of the United States is not there to be sworn in, the President-elect is not there to be sworn in, then the Vice President gets the job. But now, no, I don't believe we address the situation where he's disabled. I don't find that's addressed in the Constitution. What we move into the 25th. Ken, you can be helpful with that.
I'm not sure. I think you're right.
I think that could be taken care of by statute in some ways. The Electoral College, for example, is an autonomous body up until the moment that they cast their ballots, which is very close to the inaugural process. It would take a lot of courage for the Electoral College to come up with a fresh meat on, I think probably they have the power to do that if there's nobody around to be designated. It would be interesting to see, but I don't recommend it as a regular exercise.
Other questions? Mrs. Griswold.
Mr. Butler, if you were to get your way and the vice presidential duties were to go back to being simply preparatory to becoming president, would it then be possible to select a different way of choosing a vice president than having him named by the nominee?
Well, you've got to... First, to begin with, you got to have an acknowledgement that there's a problem before you have a solution. And so the first step is that there's not enough of an awareness of the problem to work out a constitutional change. So now the next question is, what you're really asking me is, can we change the process by which the parties select the vice presidential nominee? And I think it was only Adlai Stevenson threw it open to the Democratic Convention, and I believe Kefauver was the nominee in that. Is that correct?
I think so.
That's the only time when they've ever turned them loose in recent years. I think that, you can take the bull, any presidential candidate can take the bull by the horns and say, I won't do it, let the convention do it. Or he can set parameters for the convention. There are any number of, there is an extremely powerful person. But I do not think that the parties can take that power. Well, they have the power to do it, but I don't believe that the parties can take it away from the presidential candidate The reason I feel that way is that the presidential candidate generally has control of the machinery of his party, and he's not going to put any revolutionaries in charge of his destiny. Could be wrong, because I've seen the Democratic Party, you know, change their selection process completely. So I don't want to be too critical, but I wonder how representative it is of the Democratic, the grassroots Democrats now, as because of all these quotas and things that they've got. And of course, I would not think that was the way that the presidential candidates would have liked to see it done. It's within the power of the parties to change the process, to answer your question, any number of ways. But the big hurdle is always going to be the man that's at the head of the party, and I suspect that powers just are not likely to surrender.
Is the constitutional or the political obstacle greatest to the proposal that Tom Wicker and Ed Yoder made, that you wait for the selection of the vice president until after the election, that there be no vice president on the ticket?
I think the 12th Amendment requires the electors to vote for a vice president and a president.
So you need a constitutional amendment.
You need a constitutional amendment, and that goes back to what I say. The problem is not that apparent that the Constitution could be changed to accomplish that. If there were no nominee for vice president, and you elected the electors and gave them a free discretion to do whatever they wanted to, you might be able to get away with it constitutionally. But the way I read the 12th Amendment, it's certainly implicit in that there will be a vice president's name on the ballot. That's why I suggest that thing to do is to invoke that selection process after the inauguration of the vice president, and make that deal with your vice president that he may not have to serve the whole time, and let's invoke the second section of the 25th Amendment after that, further down the road when it becomes apparent that when the president is more secure in himself and in his position and comfortable, then he can pick somebody else if the first guy wants to stand aside. And if you get the right guy as your vice president, I think that he'd be willing to do that.
Just to push you one more step, what about the argument when the Kissinger group proposed that Gerry Ford be the vice president, but almost a co-president in the 1980 campaign, and neither Reagan nor Ford were amenable to that.
You would have to overcome a lot of natural humility to want a co-president after you fought that hard for the job. And I just don't think that's in the nature of presidents. I would have thought, however, that Gerald Ford would have been a very, very good person standing by for the to be president if anything happened to the president. And I was a little bit surprised, but he just wasn't a bit interested. And I guess he'd after all, he'd been in public office over 40 years, he probably had enough of it. But that to me would have been a fine way to do it, not to call them co-presidents, but just, you know, president in waiting ain't no bad job. And I was kind of disappointed that they didn't work that out. You have to keep in mind, though, that Henry Kissinger
was the promoter.
It was the promoter, yeah. He's got a lot of humility too. But there's a constitutional prohibition against him being president of the United States, and I'm surprised that he didn't suggest that the Constitution be amended.
Isn't this question of the vice presidency, you know, pro and con, covered by Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, which says in the second sentence, the president, shall hold his office during the term of 4 years and, together with the vice president chosen for the same term, be elected as follows, which of course the following paragraph is replaced by the 12th Amendment. But that says right there that you're going to have a vice president, you're going to be elected at the same time for the same term. What's this question about no vice president?
Well, that's Tom Wicker's stuff. Yeah.
Tom Wicker. I'm concerned about the Constitution. That's the answer, not Tom Wicker's comment.
And then you go to the Article 12, and it says that electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president. That seems to me is does it.
Yeah, well,
I don't think they can get out.
We either go to the Constitution itself or the 12th Amendment. Both of them, evidently, Mr. Wicker didn't read.
Well, there's several of them. There were several columnists that put forward this view at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Crispell?
Let me shift gears a minute. Although one of the things we learned during the hearing was that during the shooting, during assassination, the White House staff made the decision not to invoke either 3 or 4. Then we learned the president was given the choice by the White House staff whether to write that terrible letter or to invoke Section 3.
This was in the second instance.
Yeah, this is a cancer operation. And then we learned, which I think was catastrophic, that again, the White House staff, after talking to the surgeon, not to the White House physician, made the decision it was time for the president to resign power. Now, since our meetings, have you come up with any ideas how to limit the power of the White House staff? If you don't do that, I don't think the vice president will still be a nothing. I'm not being facetious.
No. Assassination is one option. I think that's probably the only effective way to limit the power of the White House staff.
But it's a very serious problem in these two instances. It was the staff that interfered.
And it bothers me as it does you that they turned to a surgeon to make that judgment instead of the regular physician or someone a little higher up in the hierarchy of
the president. Well, if the patient survives, the surgeon's always going to say he's in good shape.
Usually they say he's in better before than they started. You know?
He has to for his own ego.
Yeah. No, but it's true, and the embarrassing thing about it is that the president's counsel during this time was a university law graduate, and that also bothers me because I felt like he could have done it.
He didn't graduate in your class.
No. He's another generation, I guess. But the problem is you do all of this ahead of time. You sit down with the president, and that's the basic recommendation of the commission, is that during the period between election and inauguration, that you hash this out between your vice president, your president, or your White House position, your staff, and indeed you indoctrinate your cabinet as to what their responsibilities are under the Section 4. But the big thing is the White House position has got to have the confidence of the president. The White House's position has got to have a relationship with the president he's not going to have any mental reservations about the ethics of communicating presidential disability to the vice president and the cabinet And he's got to have the president enough confidence in, that the president will listen to him. That's a relationship that you don't develop overnight, but it's one that, that you have to work on. Then you've got to have all of the papers done, and Kerry, that should be as much a part of the presidential entourage as the black box. It should be that, because after all, this is the instrument that should have been executed by President Reagan as soon as the emergency facilities had taken place, emergency stuff had been done following the attempted assassination. The White House staff involved in this sort of thing made the judgments not to invoke Section 3 and Section 4, not out of an effort to preserve power. That was being taken care of by the Secretary of State, if you'll remember, over in the White House. Not in an effort to preserve power, but out of ignorance. And so the important thing is a real careful indoctrination of the staff and as to the significance of this article, Section 3, and how to invoke it, and to make them appreciate that the routine use of it is far more beneficial to the country than the use of it only under extraordinary circumstances. That, I think, is really the substance of what we had to say, and I think that's important, and I'm truly hopeful that when as soon as the President of the United States has been selected in November, the first person they call is Ken Thompson, and he'll show up and show them how to deal with these problems. Whatever it is, during that 10-week interval between selection and inauguration is very critical to develop a knowledge and method of living with the 25th Amendment. And all things considered, it's a pretty salutary contribution to our Constitution. And while I had no part in drafting it, I'm very comfortable with it and believe that it can see us through some pretty difficult times if they occur, and I hope they don't. Thank you.
I spent the first hour and a half today on the phone with some people who may be able to arrange for a visit in December for the man who's been called a great communicator, and we hope very much that will work out. When I listened to the Watergate hearing and heard comments from time to time by Caldwell Butler, when I heard him subsequently on the hustings, when I listened to him on the commission, I had the pretty definite feeling that here was another great communicator, and you've had a good example of that this morning. So many of us wish that he had not made the decision he made a few years back not to continue in public service, but we're terribly grateful that from time to time he helps out those who are in public service, and hope he'll continue to do that. Thank you very much.